Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Each week, Brenda brings you interesting guests and timely topics to uplift and motivate you to be all that you can be today and for all your tomorrows. Join Brenda and Alive to Thrive every Friday at noon Central Time, right here on Greater Good Ministries Radio. And now, here's Brenda Fraser.
Hello, and welcome to Alive to Thrive. My guest today has a very interesting life story and has been involved in many, many interesting crime-solving issues around the country, and has a couple of books out. She is known as the psychic, one of the TV psychic detectives. And, you know, I was introduced to her by a previous guest of mine, Karen Sullivan, here of Missouri. And I want to thank Karen for introducing me to Nancy Meyer, my guest today on Alive to Thrive. Nancy is from the East Coast area, from Pennsylvania, and was born in upstate New York, and through a series of very interesting life experiences has developed her psychic abilities. And want to welcome Nancy to the show. Welcome, Nancy.
Hello there. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
It's always amazing to me when the technology does work correctly. So
exactly. I was afraid when I called in and I got put on hold, I was like, okay, I'm on the guest hold line. She'll never know I'm there, and she'll think I haven't showed up.
Oh, no. Oh, we can see things here on our end. Yeah. So,
but you're right.
The
technology is pretty amazing to do a radio interview over the phone, and it's awesome.
Yeah, and it goes all over the world. Blog Talk has listeners all over the world and hosts from everywhere. So we love that we can get the messages out of positive talk radio and positive messages and stories of hope. And one of the things that did attract me to your story, Nancy, was your philosophy that death doesn't stop love. And I really resonate with that, having lost my mom several years ago, but really feeling connected to her. And you know, you talk a lot about in your book that just came out last year, Travels with My Father, that death doesn't separate those bonds of love. And was wondering if you want to get started talking just a little bit about how, you know, after your father died, that first visit with him, and how that sort of touched off your awareness that you had these psychic gifts.
Well, my dad died very young at 54, and quite suddenly he had a massive coronary, and the whole family was in a state of shock because he was the kind of guy that did everything right and seemed so healthy, and to have died like that, it was just very shocking. And I was sitting in my living room folding my first child's diapers, and all of a sudden there he was, sitting in a chair across the room. I've got this diaper up in the air getting ready to fold it, and I didn't dare move. I was afraid that he would disappear. It was weird because I wasn't at any time afraid of him at all. I knew he had to be a ghost because I just went to his funeral, And his big concern was my mother. And they had the most incredible love story. And my whole effort initially, I'm tired of seeing all these negative messages about men are horrible and, you know, one murderer right after the other is male, and it's all anti-male. And that bothers me because I had a wonderful father. And his love for my mother was just incredible. He's everybody's dream husband. I mean, he was just wonderful to her, and she was wonderful to him. And I thought, you know, that kind of love doesn't happen very often in the world today. And I wanted to honor that. But then the whole event that followed, one appearance right after the other of my father's ghost, helping me to help my mother, helping me to cope with working on murder cases. I mean, when I worked my first murder of a child, it just tore my heart out. And I thought, I'm not doing this. I cannot tolerate working on horrible things like this. And my dad showed up and he said, who else will do it? And he was a teacher in life. And I thought, oh, he's right. I mean, who else will do this? The skill I have is not common, even among people who claim to be psychics. My abilities are stronger than average. And it just hit me that he was right. If I could not get my courage together and deal with that to help, who was going to do it? But he was
curious.
I mean, he was a good, strong teacher. And, you know, he was just a very special person.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, Nancy, why you choose to use the word ghost in your book. It kind of struck me kind of surprisingly because it's not a word you normally see. You know, maybe people that connect with people that are departed talk about spirits or souls. But why did you choose to use the word ghost?
Because as a writer and a person who loves words, the definition of a ghost is very clear. It's the returned spirit of someone who's died. And I think that people get afraid of terminology unnecessarily, and that's the correct term for what he is. Is he a spiritual teacher also? Yes. Is he a loving father and a loving husband? Yes. He's all of those things. But he's also a dead person whose spirit came back to help. And I don't consider that to be... on the one hand, it's not a rare event. On the other hand, it is not a usual event either. And sometimes you just I'm a very straight shooter, and, you know, people have told me before, you really should change your title from being a psychic to detective to something else, because the word psychic has a bad connotation. But the reality is, by definition, that's what I am. And I don't think you should be rearranging the terminology because people are afraid of ghosts or whatever, because not all ghosts are bad, and I think about 80% of the population's well aware of that.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to your childhood, because you had some very unusual experiences that are written about in your book, Travels with My Father, and that were very fascinating. It's a quick read. In terms of being engaged with this young girl who knew she was different, she connected with nature and animals, and I love the story about the seal that followed you around while you were swimming and even up onto the beach. But what were some of those experiences like when you were younger? Like, when did you first realize that you were different from other kids, that you had sort of some gifts to connect with nature and connect possibly with people
departed? Yeah. I think one of the first times that I realized how different I was, my dad joined the U.S. Foreign Service when I was 5, and we were first sent to Brazil. And my parents prepared me for everything except the fact that They speak Portuguese in Brazil, and I don't speak Portuguese. And so when I started trying to talk to people and no one understood me, I was really confused because I could sense people's thoughts. I had a general idea of what they were saying to me. I expected them to be able to do the same thing with me, and nobody could. And I went to my dad because he was the one I trusted with my different secrets. And I said to him, you know, how come they can't understand me, but I can sort of understand them? And he didn't understand what I was talking about, but so I explained it to him, and he just kind of looked at me, and then he said, well, I have a little bit of that, and that's an intuitive skill that isn't very common, so other people don't have that. Well, I got mad at my parents because they didn't explain about the different language. I learned a good bit of Portuguese in about 3 months' time and quit speaking English. That was my idea as a 5.5, 6-year-old person of getting even. You tell me that I'm not going to be able to comprehend people, or you're not going to comprehend me. I was not an easy child to deal with that way, but my dad thought it was funny. But I had to learn different languages, move from culture to culture. And as an adult, when I really began to understand my abilities better, I thought, what incredible training I had. And I'm sure that was in God's plan that I went from culture to culture to culture, learning how human beings behave in completely different cultures. It was quite an education. It's come in really handy when I'm working cases all over the world because I understand other cultures much better than I would have if I'd just been raised in one place in the U.S.
And so one of the places you lived was Chile, and you met a woman named Rose who was she from Austria, I believe?
I believe she was.
She was from Austria, and she had a twin, and this was kind of a moment for me when I saw her twin's sister's name was Lily, because that's the name of my mother's angel. So I was like, hi, Mom, you know, when I'm reading your book. But that Rose had been the subject of some medical experimentations, and her sister ultimately died from those medical experiments, and Rose was sexually assaulted and had such a very difficult life in Europe before she went over to South America. Did you ever connect with Lily? Did you ever try to connect with Lily?
Lily did not appear, and sometimes if a soul has been very traumatized, they don't appear. But at that time, I was 9 years old. I really hadn't communicated very often with anything other than family members at that time, and I was so shocked by what Rose shared with me. Her family was shocked because apparently she hadn't spoken to anyone outside the family about what she went through in the Nazi death camps. So when she began to talk to me, we needed a translator, and her great niece, I think it was translating for us. And I didn't know anything about the Nazis or things like that, so I was quite shocked by the fact that two children who really at the time they were tortured were not much older than I was at that time, that people would treat children that way. It was a very shocking thing for me. But she told me then that she was telling me because she knew that one day I would be able to tell her story and then she would be remembered and people would not forget to keep the world from having atrocities like that again. And it seemed like such an off-the-wall thing, but I guess Rose must have been pretty psychic also because somehow she knew that I would be somewhat visible as an adult, so she gave me the gift of that story. And as I grew up and learned more about that part of history, I realized that this is a story that needs to be shared. But this is the first time I ever shared that story publicly. I didn't know.
Well, and have you been to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C.?
No, I have not. There are things that are difficult for me to do that would not bother other people. For example, on 9/11, the plane that crashed in Somerset flew over the school where I was teaching and went right past my apartment. And I was standing at the window, and I looked into the fuselage and saw the people trying to attack the cabin. And then within minutes, that plane was down. It's 45 minutes from or less from where I live. I can't bring myself to go because I know I'm going to pick their suffering up. And it was hard enough watching that plane and knowing that they were so impossibly low that there wasn't any way they were going to survive. So to go to the Holocaust Museum, which has a lot of artifacts from actual people that were mistreated, it's hard for me because I'm going to pick that up. I just have not done that yet, and I don't know whether I could handle that or not. I've been to battlegrounds. I mean, this part of the U.S. is full of battlegrounds from the French and Indian War, which, in my opinion, was a very brutal war. And so, you know, just driving around, you're going to cross ground where there were brutal battles. So I know that the earth holds terrible memories for a long period of time. And when I'm visiting sites and stuff, I pick that up. And sometimes it's pretty hard to handle that.
I was going to ask you this later in the program, but since you were talking about 9/11 and the plane, et cetera, someone wanted me to ask you about the Malaysian plane that's disappeared. Have you had any thoughts or feelings or insight into what happened there?
Well, here's the weird thing about this particular missing plane. I've ranged missing planes before. I usually get the images of the crash site and things like that. I'm not getting that from this plane, which is very strange. I'm not getting the sense of an explosion. It seems unreal to me that it's actually crashed somewhere because I can't sense it. Now, what that means, I don't know, because this has never happened before. I always get the sense of the crash or something like that. So I'm starting to wonder if the plane has crashed. Whatever happened, there is a period of time that that plane seems to be fine. So I'm just not feeling a mechanical issue at all. So I have suspected from the beginning that either it was hijacked or there was something wrong with the people or it depressurized. Because there was one other plane that did something like this one years ago when that golfer's plane depressurized and it kept on flying. I had similar impressions from that accident as I'm having now. It's almost like the thought patterns stop all at once, but there's no, I can't sense an explosion or stuff like that. So it's a very odd impression that I'm getting. It's not typical of plane crashes at all.
Well, one of the things I, you know, I liked in also in your book about you know, you're following the Dalai Lama and the belief that, you know, there's one source and that we're all one. And then, you know, getting back to the Nazis, how they separated out people. And one of the groups of people that they did persecute was the gypsies. And I worked at the Holocaust Museums. That's why I asked you that question. And I knew very little about the history before working there. And, I mean, you do feel the sorrow, but you also feel the hope because they do have a floor dedicated to the stories of the rescuers and the people that risk their lives to save others. So it actually ends on a very uplifting, positive note, and the people that survived. And then, you know, meeting some Holocaust survivors and just their resiliency. But tell us about the experience you had when you were a younger child about encountering gypsies, because that's a group of people that has been often maligned and stereotyped to things. But you had an encounter where they kind of confirmed and told you that you were a healer and that you would have visions. Talk about that story a little bit.
Well, when we were stationed in Chile, we were stationed in a city called Chillán, which you may have heard of several years ago when they had that horrible earthquake. Chillán was badly damaged, which it has historically been damaged badly whenever they had big earthquakes down there. And at that time, there were gypsy tribes in the area. And it's something that as a child you hear about from other children at schools, watch out for the gypsies, they steal children. I mean, they have these beliefs about the gypsies, which are not necessarily true, but children believe these things. And I was in second grade at that time. And then all of a sudden, I mean, I used to ride my bicycle around. You could do things at that time a little more safely than children can today. And I started being followed by the gypsies. Excuse me. And I was kind of frightened because these strange people were following me. They dressed differently. They spoke a language I didn't understand. And they would try to speak to me, excuse me, in their language, and I couldn't understand them. And I talked to my dad about it, and he spoke to a good friend of his who was a Carabinero lieutenant, which is a police lieutenant. And we were at the market one day, and this man came up to me in a costume that was different. He actually looked like a Spanish flamenco dancer. And he started speaking to me, first in his language, realizing I didn't understand it. He spoke to me in accented Spanish, and he told me that I was a star child, and I'm like, what are you talking about? And he explained that he saw around my head a crown of stars, and that that meant to him that I was going to be very visible and speak to many people and teach many people. And he told me, you know, a number of things about my future, which have all come true. And he told me that he was putting me under his protection and that I should not be afraid that the gypsies were not going to steal me. They wanted to honor me, which I wasn't particularly buying. But that was the way he was talking. And the Carabinero guy came over to see what was going on and spoke to him about the way I was feeling frightened of his people. And he said that he would tell everyone to leave me alone. And they did. After that, they didn't follow me all over the place. But every now and then, I would see him again, and he would always take his hat off and bow to me and talk about, don't forget, you're a star child, you have a responsibility. He talked about the healing skills I have and about my second sight. And it's really it was the first time in my life that a complete stranger looked at me and essentially read me. That had not ever happened before. So that has stuck in my memory for other people have done that since then who actually didn't realize who I was. It's kind of funny because there are pictures on my website and on my Facebook page, but people still don't always realize who I am, and sometimes someone who has intuitive ability will come up and say, do you know this, 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 and this? And I say, yeah, I do. But
now,
that
now
was...
with your... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you about your connection with animals because I sort of got the sense or feeling by reading your book that that you believe animals have souls, and I was wondering if you've connected with any of your past pets or beloved pets that were part of your family, and or if you've had anyone ask you to connect with their pets.
Yes, yes, and yes.
Okay.
I do believe that I know animals have souls. It's not just a belief. They do. They are such treasures and live within their environments with much less harm than we do to our environments. And the soul is just not a wasted thing. I mean, it continues. I have had pets come back, and I had a really funny one. I used to live in Wendover, and I had a separate room to do readings, and my living room was, my formal living room was where people waited. And then the stairs to go up to the bedrooms were right beside the living room. And sometimes nosy people would, or as they say in Pittsburgh, nebby people would want to sneak up the stairs and see what my house was like. Well, there was a dog that sat on those stairs, actually two beagles that would hang out on the stairs, And it was kind of funny because on more than one occasion people said, your dogs growled at me. And I said, oh, they did. And then they'd explain how there were two beagles on the steps and one was smaller than the other and that the smaller one was doing all the growling. And I said, well, were you near the steps? Well, yeah, I was being a little nosy. And I said, and the dog told you to get back in the living room, essentially. And they said, yes. Well, it turns out the bigger beagle who didn't growl was my first beagle that we called George, and the little beagle was alive. The first beagle had died years before, but used to hang out with George the second. And George the second was the one that would growl, but they often saw the two dogs together. I never told the clients that one of those dogs was dead because that would have freaked them out completely.
But if they're listening, they know now.
Now, cat out of the bag.
Yeah, the cat's out of the bag. So when did you first start working with the police department? You have done a lot of work, almost 800 cases to date. What year was that when you first got asked to help come in on a crime-solving situation?
Probably 1975 or 1976. I think it was the tail end of 75 when I started working with the police because my daughter was born in 1976, and I was pregnant when I worked a lot of the early cases with the Delaware State Police and Wilmington Police. So 1975, 1976, I went to a seminar, and a man gave his ring to another policeman to give to me, and I started doing the reading, holding the ring in my hand, and I'm looking right at the guy that actually owned the ring, and I started to divulge the new job he was going to get, and he just stood up quickly and said, please don't talk about that. It isn't public knowledge yet. But I stuck it to him a little bit for trying to trick me, and I said a little bit more, and he was about to become the colonel, the top cop in the Delaware State Police. Only nobody was supposed to know. But the cops who were in the room left that day knowing who the new colonel was going to be. And he was just wagging his finger at me.
So you were living in Delaware at the time?
Yes, that's where my career started. I started working as a professional psychic. My name at that time was my first husband's name, Anderson, Nancy Anderson. And I worked there for quite a few years before moving to Pennsylvania after my divorce from my first husband.
So you went back to your maiden name to write your book?
Well, I was married twice. In both times, it was Nancy Anderson, Nancy Zettley. After my second marriage, I formally retook my maiden name, and I'm not changing my name again. Whether I marry again or not, I'm going to remain Nancy.
So many women authors have changed their names, and then it's hard to trace their history.
Exactly.
And stay up with them.
I always carried my maiden name as my middle name, so it'd be Nancy Meyer Anderson, Nancy Meyer Zettley. I carried it the whole time as my middle name, so
I always
had it with me.
And you are so connected to your dad, Fred Meyer, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So are you working now in Pennsylvania with the police there?
Yes. I have been doing police work for 40-some-odd years now. It's over 850 cases, but they come in from all over the place. Usually family members send me the cases, but sometimes police departments do too. I've worked with police departments in different countries and in the United States. There's a nice thing about telepathy is distance makes no difference at all.
Right. So you can... people can contact you. I do want to make sure people know your website. It's Nancy Meyer, and it's spelled M-Y-E-R, Nancy Meyer hyphen or dash psychicdetective.com. You can reach Nancy there. There's links to her book, Travels with My Father, and contact her, her email and her phone number there, and her picture of her beautiful black lab also is there. So more about Nancy coming up after a break. We're going to take a short station identification. We'll be right back. You're listening to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser and my interview with Nancy Meyer, psychic detective and author and interesting personality here today on Alive to Thrive. We'll be right back.
We're open for business. The Greater Good Ministries Book and Gift Shop is now open for business, featuring metaphysical and uplifting books from your favorite authors, such as Doreen Virtue, Wayne Dyer, Michael Edward Owens. We've added handcrafted one-of-a-kind jewelry, pendants, earrings, and bracelets, and now have an exclusive selection of crystals, rocks, and stones for your metaphysical toolbox. Take a look at our hand-dug Arkansas crystals, imported Brazilian crystals, Tibetan crystals, and Reiki healing stones. All of our rocks, crystals, and stones have been Reiki infused, blessed, and cleared, ready for use. You can reserve your copy of Crystal Healing 2012 and Beyond, Reverend B's new book, A Comprehensive Guide of Rocks, Crystals, and Stones for the New Age. Visit ggmradio.com and click Bookshop in the menu bar. That's ggmradio.com.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Take a deep breath in and let go of the time you and your son played basketball and you attempted to slam dunk. Or when you hit that piñata into your neighbor's yard. Let it go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Frazier on GGM. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Alive to Thrive. My guest today is Nancy Meyer. She has written a couple of books. The most recently is called Travels with My Father, A Life, Death, and a Psychic Detective. And it's somewhat a personal memoir of her journeys through life, her experiences getting into her, you know, getting more in touch with psychic abilities, and now helping to solve murder cases. So, Nancy, you talk about a lot about in your book, you know, about how difficult that is to get back in touch with someone who has been a victim of a crime to those final moments as they are facing perhaps assault or a very violent death. How have you been able to shake that off or detach so that you can function in life and not have all the grief overtake you?
Well, when I first started working, I had great difficulty with that because I'm really a pretty fine-tuned instrument in picking up other people's pain and agony, and certainly terror when they're being murdered and attacked was rough on me, especially the first killings that I worked of very young children. And I realized that this was not survivable if I couldn't figure out a technique where I could do it, but it wouldn't get inside of me as much. So I developed the technique of standing immediately beside the victim. It doesn't always work. Sometimes I still get sucked into the victim's thoughts, but I tried to do the imagery by standing beside them so that I could look in any direction and see what was going on, notice important pieces of evidence that might be overlooked, things like that. The other part of it was I had always been someone who liked to read detective stories, and I grew up reading about criminal activities in Life magazine. I was always fascinated by the field, and I had a way of looking at things that made more sense to cops, and I think that made a big difference. They have told me over the years some hilarious stories about other people with psychic abilities who worked in a pretty disorganized way, and they would say they really liked working with me because I went from A to B to C in a way they could follow and it made sense. And then in while I would be describing to them what was going on, my explanations would explain some of the evidence that they had that they didn't completely understand. And one of the police officers I worked with years ago said that on average I saved them 6 months of legwork. You know, it wasn't so much that they might not
have.
So
when you begin to work on a case, do they tell you some basic facts of what they know and then you piece together, you know, tune in? Do they ever give you a piece of clothing from the victim?
I need the date of death, if they know it, or the date the body was found. I usually work from photos of the crime scene itself, and I'll go through the photos. I'm not looking, trying to look at gory photos, but I'll pick out a few of the photos where the killer dropped his guard, and I can sense the killer's thoughts. And then I'm into the killer's head, and then I can tell them, how did they know the victim? Is it a chance encounter? Is this someone who knows the victim? I can tell them about what they look like, sometimes where they hid weapons, how they came and went. That proved to be pretty critical on a case from Maryland that a friend of the murderer drove him to the scene and then drove him away, which makes him an accessory because he didn't come forward. I described that the two worked together at the same job, and I described the vehicle that they came and went in. I also told them there had been an eyewitness across the street who had not come forward, and they were able to solve the case because of those two key pieces of information that they got the friend who finally admitted that he had driven the killer to and from, and he couldn't have not known because it was a stabbing. The killer came out totally covered in blood. And so the young man who drove him away knew that he had killed that person. And the lady across the street that had witnessed it, she went into hiding because she knew the killer as well, because it was a family member from the victim. So she was afraid he'd come after her if she knew that he had.
Now, are you ever concerned about your own safety if these people don't get convicted or if they ever get out of jail?
You have to be wary about that, but it's kind of like living in earthquake territory, which I did for many, many years. You know the risk is there. You have to be careful, and you just go on living. I mean, that's just the way life is for me.
And one of the things you talk about in your book is that you've always felt that your father has protected you, including a car crash that you were aiming right for a telephone pole, and that was an interesting story of feeling that your father kind of stepped in and saved you from a more serious crash. Can you talk about that story?
I was driving a VW Bug, which is not the biggest car in the world, and it went out of control and headed for a phone pole, and I could not get the steering wheel to turn to avoid the phone pole. And my dad's hands came down on top of mine and helped me turn the steering wheel. And I ended up with bruises all over the back of my hand. So if I had any worry that I hadn't seen what I saw, I mean, I recognized the hands when they came down, and he gripped me really hard and turned the wheel. And the bruises on the back of my hands were partly fingerprints and partly just bruises where he had gripped me. So it's like for days I was looking at the bruises on the back of my hands, knowing that my father saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind.
And so you talk a little bit about the physical sensations. You know, that certainly is a physical effect. But you also talk about feeling a cold draft when your father would appear. Do you feel that cold draft when you have any spirit visit with you, or...
Yes.
Is that only
one
sometimes?
Of the things that's interesting to me is when someone from the other side enters a room with human beings that are still living, you can feel a cold spot or a cold draft. That's partly because they use some of our energy to make appearances. So as that energy gets used and pulled away from you, you feel it as a cold sensation. There's a temperature difference, and sometimes it can be.
So that's why when people walk into an old house or a house perhaps where someone has died, they can say they, you know, sort of feel that person or They.
Well, I think so all of us have some psychic ability. I'm a bit over, but a lot of people have that sense. And, you know, suddenly you'll be standing in a place that you don't know, and you just feel the hair all over your body go up, and you know there's something evil around. I mean, these are survival instincts that we have from the animal kingdom. You know, animals know danger. They know it before we do. There's part of that. Some people call it your lizard brain, which I don't like the sound of that, but, you know, it's a residue of our early senses, and it still works to try and protect us.
Yeah, a friend of mine is a former police officer, and actually she's writing a crime fiction novel right now. Her name is Patrice Billings, and she talks about a scene where she landed her helicopter that she flew, and they saw a suspicious vehicle in the woods, and, you know, her and her flying partner had their guns drawn, and the hairs on the back of her neck stood up, and she had never really experienced that before. And it turns out later, when this person that was hiding in the woods was captured and interrogated, they said, yeah, I was just about to blow those officers, those helicopter pilots away. So, you know, she has experienced that, very much so.
Yeah.
And so saying, it just confirms that.
Well, and it's important for people to know that that instinct is there. So if you are going in a direction and you suddenly feel that kind of danger signal on your body, you need to pay attention to it. I mean, if you're driving down the road and you're feeling that way, turn off the road you're on and get onto another one. I mean, I've avoided a number of really bad pileups on roads by turning into a parking lot, pulling over, or getting off the road I was on, and then sitting there watching the accident happen, but I'm not in it, and knowing that if I hadn't responded to that warning, I'd have been in the middle of the accident.
Mm-hmm. And so sometimes detours in life are for our own protection or led down another road. Let's talk about, you know, you know, when you're working on a case, about reading the history of an object. So you can hold on to an object that belonged to someone and pick up sort of some history, good or bad, about that item?
Yes. It's kind of funny because it's called psychometry, and you hold something and impressions just flow into my mind. And in the early days, I worked using the psychometry to get things started. It was kind of handy because people get nervous around me. I mean, some people get really scared of me, even though they have come for a reading. They get frightened. And if I was holding an object, they would sit and watch my hand, and it would drop their guard enough that I could get information. But what's really funny is if someone gives me an antique piece of jewelry, I'll go right down the line, you know, one owner right after the other. And it takes a while sometimes to get to the current owner because the strongest impressions on that piece of jewelry may come from one of the earlier owners. And I do that with houses, too. I mean, I walked into this house that I bought. I live in a Victorian, and my son calls her the money pit, but, you know, she's taken a lot of work. And I knew the very first day I walked in with the real estate agent, I instantly knew some of the history of the house, and I knew there was a friendly ghost in that. Well, she would be friendly if I was nice to her house. There was a ghost in residence, and I still see her, but she likes the way I've decorated and improved the house, so we get along fine. And
sort of friends with her.
Yes.
Now, is there anything that people can do if they feel that they have a ghost living with them that they don't want there?
Yes.
To
you directly ask God to remove the problem, because really ghosts are not supposed to be threatening or hurting us. And unfortunately, you know, just because you died, it doesn't turn you into a nice person. There are some nasty people out there, and you can get help directly by asking God and using imagery of green healing light filling your whole house up and going out several feet beyond, it's very, and then pulling in white light, like sunlight white light, it's hard for negative spirits to coexist with that kind of energy, and that will often shove a bad haunting away.
And so do you think that decorating with those, with the colors green as well, or using sage? I know some people say, you know, smudge the house with sage.
Yeah, that's a North American Indian tradition, and they also use that. The South American Indians also use that. But that's a positive energy thing, too. The sage smoke produces a positive energy, and again, negative spirits have a hard time coexisting. I think it's really good. I always put healing energy into whatever home I live in and, you know, fill it regularly with green light and white light to give it a better atmosphere. So that's something that you can do too. You can make your house have better energy by visualizing it, filling up with dark green emerald light, and then following that with white light.
Mm-hmm. And so what's it been like since the book's been out? Are you on tour with it? Are you just speaking in your area where you live there in Pennsylvania, or what are your plans for the book?
Well, the book just came out in late fall, and our weather has been horrendous out here. So I'm going to be doing some traveling this summer. I also teach part-time at a college, and my teaching load, I think this summer is not going to be as heavy. So I'm going to do some traveling this summer promoting the book. I'm planning to go down to Delaware, for one thing, which is where the event started and the early parts of the book take place. But I've been, you know, talking to people and doing local promotions. I teach meditation seminars, and I'm getting ready to have one either in April or May. I've been waiting to see when is this winter going to stop so that I can do a spring seminar, because by the time you're through with a tough winter like this, everybody's glands are a mess. So I want to do a spring seminar and help people to get rebalanced again.
Mm-hmm. And are you doing any seminars online yet, or is that something you're going to look into maybe?
I'm going to look into that, Brenda. I have not figured out how to do all of the technology yet. I usually am so busy working cases and teaching, and I'm also completing work or trying to complete work on my doctorate. So I've just been kind of overloaded. So I'm trying to get figuring out how to do some of the stuff that, you know, do a blog thing and stuff like that. I'm trying to learn how to do that.
Well, we'll be happy to talk with you offline about some of those things that we can help you with your social media and your getting some of these seminars online, because with technology you could teach, you know, there's some different things I could tell you about later. So what else is happening new? You're getting your doctorates. That's unbelievable. That's a huge undertaking. What can you share what your thesis will be on?
My dissertation is going to be about better ways to teach college writing. We have a serious failure to educate going on with high school students now. We're almost 50% of high school graduates cannot write well enough to pass college writing courses. It's quite serious, and I'm trying to figure out a way to teach college writing better so that we can get people on track who have not had a good education in high school so that they can learn more in college and benefit from that to get better jobs and stuff. There's a lot of articles coming out right now about how college isn't worth the money, and as a college teacher and someone completing an education doctorate, I'm just furious. I think that that is really detrimental, because right now college is where people are picking up the knowledge they didn't get in high school, and with the quality of high school education where it is today, college education is becoming more and more important, because a lot of human resources people are no longer hiring high school graduates because they can't write well enough, they can't spell, and they don't know basic grammar. So that's what I'm working on with my dissertation, and hopefully I can get it done. It's just it's a tough thing to get a doctorate out. I got all the coursework is done. I have my Juris Doctorate, which is the first step. I'm just trying to get the dissertation proposal approved, and I'm hoping to do that this summer and then get my research done and get my degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we're finishing up, I want to be selfish and ask one question about a family member of mine that I've been wanting to write her story and share some lessons of life through my sister. She died of a sudden heart attack at age 56 about 6 years ago. And at first I thought I'd write her life story, and then I realized, well, I was 10 years younger and there were big chunks of her life that I didn't really know anything about. And then I read some articles by Emmett Fox. Do you follow his writings?
No.
Okay. So Emmett Fox talks about how that the departed takes with them all their memories. And my sister had experienced various shock treatments and various different things in the mental health community that I don't particularly agree with. But then I realized, well, I should write the book from the point of view of a sister, with having a sister that went through some of this stuff. And, you know, so in terms of trying to connect with her, to have her help me write this story, what's your advice? Having her objects near me, having her picture near me, putting on music she loved? I mean, what are some things that, you know, anyone can do, but in my, you know, particularly in this case, to connect with someone that we've loved, who's crossed over to connect and try to
The
get
first thing you need to know how to do is quiet your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily need what I refer to as props. You don't necessarily need that. What you need is to quiet your mind and get it out of the send mode. Most of the time when we're looking for information, for instance, if you're looking for information from your sister, who is now on the other side, your reflex will be to get your mind into a send mode without realizing that that completely blocks her effort to contact you. If you think of it as a CB radio, if you put your finger on the send button, you can talk, other, but you cannot hear what's coming back. So you have to get your finger off that send button and open your mind. And then, so you think of the question you want answered, and then quiet and open your mind. Relax yourself, distract yourself. It's almost like when you're looking for something you've lost, you have to let go of trying to find it before you get in the receiving mode and all of a sudden you know where it is. Does
right.
that make sense? You understand
total
what I'm saying?
Total sense, yes. I've done
and
that, yes.
This is one of the reasons why Americans have so much trouble learning how to meditate. This is exactly why. Because we tend to be, as a culture, we're go-get-em people. So we are often in the sending mode. So we're not as receptive for what's coming in. So you have to train yourself to switch modes there. Get your finger off the send button.
Well, I think that's a great way of putting it. And what are some other ways people can learn to quiet their mind and meditate and, you know, just get out of the rat race?
The type of meditation that we most often see is what I call single-track meditation. You're supposed to quiet your mind and focus on one thing. Most North Americans can't do that. You need multiple imagery. So if you take your favorite place in nature, like I love the beach, so I'll visualize myself floating around on a raft in a quiet lagoon. You know, I'm in the shade, so I'm not getting too hot. I'm just floating on the water. That's one of my favorite images. Now, if my mind, which is a very busy mind, gets bored with the image, then I'll put a bird in the sky or I'll see a dolphin. You know, just add a tiny bit to the image to keep me focused on the image and keep my mind away from the list of to-dos and all the stuff I have to do by tomorrow. I have to get essays graded, yada, yada. No, put the dolphin in there so you're watching the same image. You're still at the beach. You're watching the dolphin. It's a quiet, peaceful image still, but I've refocused my ability on that. And you do something like that a couple times a week, it will calm your whole body down. It's amazing how much of an effect just a few meditations a week will do. And the more you meditate, the more you're opening your mind to hear communication from the other side. That's a natural part of it.
Suzanne Giesman talks about that, too. She was on my program. She wrote Messages of Hope, another fantastic book about connecting with our loved ones. And are you familiar with that book, or Suzanne?
I've heard of it. Yeah, I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I need to connect you with her. It has a really fascinating story as well. But, you know, one of the things you talked about was, you know, and I totally agree with this, that time is not linear and that everything exists at one time or all at once. And Eckhart Tolle talks about that in The Power of Now. But not many people grasp that concept, do they?
Well, I think it doesn't make sense to people. Now, the people that I've spoken to that it immediately makes sense to is physicists. And they'll start talking about, I mean, they have a name for what I'm saying and stuff, and they start speaking the language of physics. I have no clue what they're talking about, but they seem to understand what I'm talking about. They just have technical terminology for it. For example, there have been occasions where I have put my hands on someone who had a broken bone and sent energy through, and the bone seems to heal very quickly. And when I was talking to five physicists once at a meeting that I went to, they all wanted to know how I felt that had happened. And I said, I think it happened because somehow my mind changes the speed at which the molecules that are matter move so they can reblend and reform. And then they started off on this big discussion in physics terms, and they lost me. I didn't know what they were talking about. But they said that that made sense to them. So the only people that I know that it's really made sense to are physicists.
And quantum physics is definitely getting more into explaining some topics that have been around for centuries with spiritual topics and things. So we just want to say thank you so much, Nancy. And again, go ahead.
It's been fun. I enjoyed working with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you, and we want to encourage our listeners to go to your website, nancymeyer-psychicdetective.com. Follow Nancy on Facebook.
On Facebook, and
post a message there, and you can set up an appointment with her from wherever you live. And coming up next week will be Cindy Meyer, the publisher of Spirit Seeker magazine. We have an expo here in the St. Louis region, the 28th Holistic Living Expo, Rejuvenate and Renew, and Cindy Meyer, who's also an expert at Feng Shui, will be our guest on Alive to Thrive, and we'll be sharing about her expo and some of the interesting speakers. Maybe Nancy will come to St. Louis one of these years for one of these expos and join us for that. So thank you, everyone. You're listening to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Please follow us on facebook.com/AliveToThrive. We'll see you next week.